This morning, we're going to start a series of talks on the Tenzo Kyokan, Instructions to the Chief Cook. This is a work written by Great Master Dogen. Dogen, of course, lived in the 1200s in Japan. He was an interesting fellow, our Dogen. He was practicing Buddhism from the age of 7, or so they say. He was born into a Buddhist family. His mother was quite devout, and his mother passed away quite early in his life, and that inspired him to seek more deeply into practice than just kind of doing what your family does. So he was well steeped in Buddhism, well steeped in the Zen tradition. Even before he went to China, where he met his, what we might call his transmission teacher, his teacher of transmission, the teacher who really helped him to awaken to a really deep understanding of practice. And so much of what Dogen is, much of the background of Dogen's work is that he was, a person deeply steeped in Buddhist practice and the ways of doing things in the Buddhist world, and he was ordained as a monk from a very early age, lived his life in monasteries, understood the way that temple life worked. And so he was, even though he spent not too long a time in China, he was, because of his background, he was able to study and understand how they practiced Buddhism in China and how that might influence his own practice. So what he brought back to Japan was a kind of product of all of this lifelong study of the Dharma and how to practice the Dharma. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk about today was how to approach a work that is translated from another language, another culture, another time. There are many translations of this particular section of Dogen's work available on the market today, and they all have strengths and weaknesses. I'm going to be talking from a translation done by the founder of our tradition, Reverend Master G.U. Kennett. This was a translation that she worked on, polished, you know, kind of did mostly while she was in Japan studying with, in the context of living in the large Zen temple, Sojiji Monastery. So this is a translation that she worked on with her teachers while she was in Japan. One of the things about that is that this is a translation that, therefore, that comes out of the experience of practice. It's not an academic translation. It's not a translation that's kind of done by a scholar of language or even a scholar of religion in the Western academic sense. This is a translation done in the context of people who want to practice the Dharma, who want to understand the Dharma from the point of view of how to put it into practice. They're very keen. One of the kind of central things about being a monk, or one of the issues of being a monk, is learning what your tradition is in detail so that you can pass it on undiluted in detail. And so one of the things about that is that in our particular tradition, we recite every morning our ancestral line, and that is a recitation of names from the time of the Buddha down through the Indian ancestors, the Chinese ancestors, the Japanese ancestors, down to the present day, to our present teachers. And that transmission line signifies that process of, it starts with Shakyamuni Buddha having an understanding and articulating how to practice to realize that understanding, and then passing that practice on to someone else who puts that teaching and practice into practice and has that understanding themselves. Critical in that is that it is virtually impossible to understand that nexus of practice and understanding simply by reading about it. It has to be put into, the Dharma has to be put into practice and made true in each individual's life. And that putting into practice is how we come to know what the Buddhas and ancestors were talking about. We are following their instructions, but we're also coming to understand more deeply what their instructions mean. So there's a cyclical kind of supportive relationship there. Again, I want to say, it is virtually impossible to understand what the Buddha was really talking about just by reading about it. And that's not because there's something secret or esoteric that's going on. It's not because there's something we're just kind of keeping from all of the unenlightened masses. That's not the issue at all. It's completely open how to access the Dharma, how to practice the Dharma. There's nothing secret about it. There's nothing that's held back. It's impossible to understand it just from reading about it because it's beyond the kind of understanding that you can get by reading about it. We must practice it in order to understand it. When we practice it, it changes us. That practice itself changes us, it changes our mind. And in that change is where we come to see more clearly what's going on, what the Buddha taught. Sometimes you hear stories of someone reading a phrase from the scriptures and having a deep awakening experience. And that, I understand that to be the culmination of a long history of practice. That person in some way was practicing, living according to the Dharma in order for that awakening to kind of come to pass. So the translation that we're working from is a translation done by people who understood that practice, that the Dharma is understood through practice. And they're people who actually did awaken to what the Dharma was pointing at. Both Reverend Master Jiyu's teachers in Japan and Reverend Master Jiyu herself awakened to and understood what the Dharma is pointing at, and knew how to put it into practice, knew how to put the Dharma into practice in order to find awakening themselves. So that's their central perspective. They're not super concerned about whether to give the translation the kind of Japanese flavor, the flavor of the Japanese language. They're not super concerned about a kind of precise one-to-one mapping of character to word or anything like that. They're not super concerned about academic issues. What they're concerned about is, how can I truly take what Dogen said and be completely true to what Dogen said, understanding that Dogen himself was really concerned about practicing the Dharma. He was very literate. He loved to read poetry and novels and whatnot. But what his main concern was in terms of what his writing and his practice was how can I pass on the teaching that I have learned in such a way that people I'm teaching can understand how to practice it. That was the heart of Dogen. That was right there at the heart of him. An example of what I mean by that is that he did most of his lecturing in the Japanese language of the day, which was a departure from how other teachers were talking at the time. They would be talking in classical Chinese at the time, or writing in classical Chinese at the time. So Dogen's masterwork, the Shobogenzo, the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, is written in the Japanese of the time. It's not written in classical Chinese. So, and at the same time, he was very concerned about monastic form and how to pass on the practice, the form of the practice. But he was able to understand the spirit of it in such a way that he could translate what he learned from China, learned from his teachers in China, into a language and a way of understanding that the Japanese people that he was talking to could understand it. So that's where River Master Jiu came in, and she, again, had a, she was very, she'd been studying Buddhism since an early age. She was pretty well steeped in it. She was well trained in Japan. She has good credentials from a kind of academic perspective, but also had a deep experience of putting the Dharma into practice. Okay. Sometimes translations that you encounter these days are stilted and have formal language, and they seem to be more concerned about linguistic issues than about how to communicate the Dharma. Sometimes they're just in not such great English, but it's clear that the person who is doing the translations understands the practice, understands the issues of practice that are being highlighted. I kind of like this. I kind of grew up reading this translation, grew up in the Dharma, and so I'm kind of familiar with it. But I also think there's something quite excellent about both the language that it's presented in. It's presented in language that we Westerners can easily understand. It doesn't obscure things in this kind of exotic way. Done some comparison between this and other translations, and I keep coming back to this one as one that I'm going to talk about from. And it may be useful for other people to explore those things. But I think it's worth kind of highlighting some of those issues as we dive into this text. So, the Tenzo Kyokan, instructions to the chief cook. Okay. So this is a work from, this is a section of a work called the Eihei Shingi, which is Dogen's rules for monastic practice. In monastic Buddhism coming from China into Japan, there is a long tradition, particularly in China, of taking the Vinaya, the rules of monastic practice, Vinaya, also pronounced as. And certainly the Chinese monks that Dogen encountered in Japan would have taken those 300 or 250 odd rules that the male monks and 300 rules that the female monks would take. Eihei Shingi means rules for the monastery. Okay, the Shingi is basically rules. And all of monastic practice is governed by rules and formal procedures. In certain sense, monastic practice is practice about practicing the form of Buddhism. And roughly speaking, lay practice is about finding the spirit of Buddhism in a sort of less formal kind of quality of practice or way of practicing. So the thing about monastic practice is it's all concerned with rules. About 400 years before Dogen, there's a monk who went to Japan, Japanese monk, I can't remember that much about him, Saicho. Anyway, he's one of the founding practitioners in Japan of Buddhism, and he, in consultation with other monks at his time, sort of dispensed with the taking of the Vinaya in Japanese Buddhist monastic practice. They sort of set it aside. And so since that time, monks in Japan have not taken all of those rules. But because they haven't taken all of those rules, they're much more keen to practice according to temple rules and rules that have been passed on to them. So something like the Eihei Shingi would have been, in a sense, the kind of guidance, the binding quality of how monks practiced in Japan. When Dogen went to China, he was accepted into Tendo's monastery, Tendo Nyojo's monastery, and was allowed to practice there even though he had not taken the Vinaya, even though he was not formally a monk in that kind of traditional sense. And he was transmitted there. So there was an accord among those two monks. But one of the things that we inherited from, and Dogen would have most likely been aware of, are the monastic rules of Yakujo. Pai Chang, I think his Chinese name was. And those are, again, guiding principles, ideas that a monastery would adopt and that would guide the way monks would practice, and there would be instructions of how monks would practice. And so, in some sense, Hyakujo's rules would be guiding Dogen's guidelines for how to practice the Dharma in a monastery. Okay. Now, one of the traditional things about a monastery is that there are six offices in the monastic structure, and they've been likened to pillars of the monastery, these six monastic offices, and the office holders are called chiji or yaku. And they are not just the practical heads of departments in the monastery structure. You have the chief cook, you have the sacristan, the person who's overseeing the ceremony hall and the ceremonies. You have the externs, this is our names at Shasta Abbey, the extern sacristy, the person who's kind of dealing with the outside work of the monastery, the support, the maintenance of the monastery. You have the bursar, the person who's involved with the offerings that are given to the temple, the treasurer, basically. You have the prior, who is the chief administrative officer of the temple. And you have the infirmarian, who's involved with the health of the monastic community. So each one of those monastic offices is not just the practical administrator of those realms, but also the spiritual teacher of those offices. So monks working in those departments, as it were, would not just be following their practical advice, leadership in terms of getting the work done that needed to be done, but they would also look at those teachers, those monastic office holders, those yaku, as their spiritual teacher, at least in terms of how they're doing their work. So one of the important issues that we're going to be looking at as we talk about the instructions for the chief cook is not just how the practical work gets done, but how to bring the Dharma practice into that practical work. And in that sense, this work, and I think one of the reasons it's become quite famous and popular, is that it really talks about how to bring practice, not just that we do on the cushion, but into our daily life, into our daily practice. How can we bring practice into how we hold our work in the world, how we relate to others? So instructions for the chief cook. And so in the Ahe Shingi, there's instructions for each one of those monastic office holders, each one of those yaku, each one of those jiji. From its inception, Zen Buddhism has had six chief offices, called the chiji in Japanese. And the priests who hold them, as the Buddha's children, the word here is sons, which at least at Shasta Abbey is not how we're practicing presently. It's not just men who can hold the chiji, hold the monastic offices. In fact, I think all of the monastic offices at Shasta Abbey are held by all of the chiji, all of the yaku are women at this point. No, the extern sacristan is still a male monk. Anyway, and the priests who hold them as the Buddha's children are jointly in charge of all the affairs of the temple. Among these, the office of Tenzo is that of chief cook, and this post is always held by a senior priest. What this means, is always held by a senior priest, means again that that monk who holds that office is, it needs to be a teacher, needs to be able to teach others, is always held by a senior monk. I should say that practically speaking, like presently, the chief cook at Shasta Abbey is a transmitted monk, so not completely a senior monk, although a senior, not a senior teacher, but a senior monk. And there was a point at which, for my own self, I was in charge of a monastic office, but I was a novice. That was very interesting and somewhat awkward. And in some way I had to have the understanding that I was not fully the yaku, the teacher of that monastic office. So in the ideal, it is always a senior priest. None but the finest priests, fully awakened to and eager for Buddhahood, have up to now ever been trusted with the office of Tenzo, for unless there is an earnest desire for Buddhahood, however great an effort the priest holding this office may make, he will not be successful therein. The Zen temple regulations state that the desire for Buddhahood must forever be kept active within the mind of the Tenzo priest, and he must, at various times, devise such dishes as will create great pleasure for the monks who partake thereof. So, I think in one sense, you could read this as saying that the chief cook must be fully enlightened in order to take up that job. But that's not exactly how I read it. None but the finest priests, fully awakened to and eager for Buddhahood, have up to now ever been trusted to the office of Tenzo, for unless there is an earnest desire for Buddhahood, however great an effort the priest holding this office may make, he will not be successful therein. I think what that is getting at is that that wish for awakening, that wish to practice the Dharma, has to be the kind of primary motivator of that person who takes on that office. the Dharma and the practice of the Dharma has to be at the forefront of what they're doing. It's not about whether you can cook or whether you can organize people or whether you can kind of do things that people like. It's about the first priority is practice. How can I bring practice to this work? How can I bring my intention to find enlightenment to this work? How can I make those things kind of work together? There's a thing Dogen says, we must do everything for the sake of Buddhism, he says. And in a way, that can seem somewhat odd. Like, I don't know, you can kind of just appear in the world as being a zealot of some kind who's constantly just thinking about the Dharma and kind of bumbling through the rest of your life. And that's not really what he's talking about there. He's not really talking about having, constantly thinking about the scriptures or constantly thinking about what the Buddha was like or anything like that. But he is talking about bringing a spirit of training and practice to what we do, the letting go of the self, the letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion, and the willingness to learn from what we are doing and the consequences of our actions in the world. There's this movie, I think it's called The Nun Story. Could be wrong about this. I get these things a little blurry after a long time of seeing them. Where there's a nun, a person who becomes a Catholic nun in an order that is dedicated to nursing people. And she's quite good at nursing people. And the story is about the interplay between her being good at nursing people and how that relates to her monastic vocation. And I think in the end, she eventually has to decide between being a nurse and being a nun. Can't remember how it resolves. And so in a certain sense, like when you're the cook at Chaste Abbey, you might have some idea of how some delightful dish that you want to present to the monks is going to come out. And you may well, it may require certain complicated steps to follow. And right in the middle of those, as the day works out, right in the middle of those certain complicated steps, the bell goes for a ceremony that you're supposed to go to. So what do you do? Do you skip the ceremony and follow up on the meal so that it will come out just right? Or do you set aside the meal and wait to come back and maybe have it not turn out quite as well as you kind of hoped it would? There's a kind of question there. What do we do? In terms of the monastery, it's not cut and dried. Sometimes you stay back and you finish the meal. But it has to be, that decision has to come from practice. The practice of letting go and asking, what is good to do here? So what I'm kind of pointing at is, when we sit down to meditate, we are letting go of whatever arises in our minds. It arises, it's there for as long as it wants to be, and it passes away. And within that arising and passing away, we're asking a question, whether we realize it or not, what is good to do with regard to this? In terms of the formal sitting meditation, a thing arises, it's there for as long as it wants to be and passes away. And we've decided that what's good to do is to sit there and to allow it to arise and pass away and do nothing. However, sometimes what's arising and passing away might be something like the smell of smoke. Something's burning. I noticed that. It's a mental phenomenon. I could just sit there and allow it to arise and pass away. I've decided to do that. But as I sit there, I realize that's not a good smell. That's a smell of the house burning down. I need to do something about that. And you get up and you respond to it. And that getting up and responding comes from that question, what is good to do? And we have the wisdom to be able to respond to that. But if we're attached to sitting, if we're attached to the form of sitting, if we're attached to our intention to sit and what that means about us, then we may ignore that impulse to get up and put out the fire. If we're attached to the outcome of our meal that we're cooking, if we're attached to how everybody's going to like us if we make this really nice food, if we're attached to any of those kind of issues around that, then we're going to miss the sense of what's good to do. Sometimes it might be, actually in the monastery this is true, sometimes it might be attached to going to the meditation hall. When I was a novice, you kind of become a novice and they tell you it's going to be like a hothouse, like you're going to just get to sit for a while and just, you know, kind of concentrate on that. But when you become a novice, you have all this work to do. You're constantly running around. You have very little time to actually just kind of quietly sit somewhere. Just kind of constantly, and you might only sit 2 or 3 times a day, which is pretty good for most of us. It's more than we get. But I've heard monks kind of say, we don't get to sit enough. and have that be a kind of ongoing complaint. But the way the monastery is structured isn't to go toward what we like, but is to point out where we're holding on, where we're holding on to our ideas about the way things ought to be. And there's an opportunity there to let go and learn how to meditate in the context of what we're doing. And so the chief cook has to be someone who is aware of all of these issues and understand their own mind and their own proclivities for where they get stuck, where they get attached. I have been a cook for most of my life, and I was actually the chief cook for about a week at Shasta Abbey one time. My health wasn't really kind of prepared for it, so I wasn't able to kind of follow through on that job. But I worked a lot in the kitchen, and I had to kind of really, and I've worked in various kitchens and temples that I've lived in. I suppose I've been the cook in other temples as well. And always I have to kind of look at that question, what is good to do and how can I let go of my distorting attachments, even while at various times devising such dishes as will create great pleasure for the monks who partake thereof. So Dogen's not saying the chief cook can just kind of put out slop for people to eat. It's not talking about a utilitarian kind of cutting off of all of the implications of food. He's saying you have to do a good job. You have to make food that people like to eat, that people want to eat, that will cause them great pleasure. But we can find a way to do that in that spirit of letting go. Where am I holding on? And in fact, what happens is the more we go into that spirit of letting go, in that place of tension between our intent to become Buddhas and our need to practically get the food out, in that tension and that space of letting go, we find this kind of greatly creative kind of place where you learn how to, get a thing to a certain point and then wrap it up and put it in the walk-in and let it sit there for a while, or something like that. You learn all kinds of different ways of handling that problem. and day to day handling that problem changes. Sometimes you have to set it aside and go to the ceremony. Sometimes you stay away from the ceremony and you handle the food. It just varies. And all the time there is that intent. How can I let go of the self? How can I let go, see clearly, greed, hate, and delusion, and let them go? And in that tension, in that place of tension, is where we find that practice, where we find how to do that. If we just are sitting on our cushion in the meditation hall and not taking on the responsibility of being the chief cook or doing whatever work we're doing, then we don't have the opportunity to find that creative place, that place of letting go and stepping beyond our selfishness into a kind of wondrous world. So, two paragraphs, we did pretty good. I think I'll call that it for this morning. Any questions or comments about this or anything else?
Well, it just seems to me that the issue of, for the chief cook, of bringing Dharma practice into his responsibilities is the same for all of us in all our daily life. That there's no real difference. We have to just find a way to bring Dharma practice to our getting up in the morning, fixing breakfast, whatever it is, we must do it
with a
dedicated heart.
That's absolutely right. And one of the issues that we'll talk about is even for a cook, even for the monastery cook, you kind of long for certain kinds of ingredients that Dogen will talk about later on.
You long for
certain kinds of ingredients, really nice ingredients,
yeah,
to make your thing that you're, and you may not get those ingredients. And that issue is actually goes to the very excellent point that you make, which is we may wake up in the morning and have to deal with our minds, and we might kind of wake up and think, oh, I wish I were waking up in the monastery and this would be easier or whatever like that. And in a sense, that's kind of longing for that special ingredient. But we have, you know, it's, Dogen says in the Shishogi that we recited this morning, this very life today is absolutely vital life. Wherever you are, whoever you are, you have the problem of bringing the Dharma to your life as it is. But you also have, the other part of that is that you have this great opportunity in that you can bring the Dharma to your life as it is. So you're absolutely right. None of us are different from the chief cook, at least in the essential thing. Yes.
It's not really about the book, although I kept hearing you saying it's so important, whether you're in the 1200 year or now, to put into practice. I know that's a pretty broad, like, I'm not in a monastery right now.
Mm-hmm.
What is the most important thing? I have to sit for an hour a day.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the most important thing? Is that, that's part of the practice, but in general, I don't live in a monastery.
Yep.
I'm surrounded, and I just moved to Portland, and I got to tell you, I'm having culture shock here, and there's not a lot in this culture that's really conducive to the practice.
Yeah.
There's food porn on the TV. There's porn. There's all these things that are going on in this culture, and I'm freaking out.
Yeah.
And all I do is just, I'm at the point where I'm so sensitive, I just sit and practice on my own. And now I'm checked out in Northeast, another Zen place. I sat for an hour and trying this out. But what is my practice other than just sitting?
Yeah. One thing I wanted to say, sort of an aside here.
Yeah.
If feel free to ask a question that you want to talk about, and if you feel like you would like to have it removed from the recording, mm-hmm. I'm happy to take it out because it's digital recording, and you may not want to do that, but I'm just reminded of that. That is a question, that's an interesting question that I've had to grapple with in my own life. I lived in Portland for a long time before I became a Buddhist I grew up in Portland and lived here for about 10 years as a lay Buddhist. And I would go off to the monastery, to Shasta Abbey as it happens, and you'd spend a week there and you'd get all immersed in this kind of formal practice and you'd kind of be all sensitive and then you you kind of drive away from the monastery and the first thing you stop in is an AM/PM mini market to use the bathroom and buy some soda or whatever, and you're kind of overwhelmed with this barrage of lights and magazines and the culture is back, and then you have to go to work the next day and kind of deal with people. And it was kind of a bit of a it took a bit of time to kind of find my way with that, to kind of recognize that, interestingly, if you spend any extended period of time, like at Shasta Abbey, you find that there are periods of intense practice, retreat practice, a session or sitting meditation mm-hmm. or retreat, and then you go into a time of less intense formal practice, where you're just doing your work and you're kind of going about your day-to-day thing. And so you kind of go in and out of intensity of practice. And over time you realize you can kind of think, oh, real practice is doing the retreat and living in daily life is what I'm kind of getting ready to live in the retreat, mm-hmm. if you see what I'm saying. But that's not very helpful in the long run, and is not, in fact, reflective of what a long-term life of practice looks like. So it is just the normal thing, and even the Buddha did this, where we go through periods of intense practice, and then we go through periods of less formal practice or finding practice in the world. So I just say that to say what you're grappling with is a pain, but is not, there's not something wrong in it or something you can kind of need to conclude that there is something missing from your life. It's more just this normal state of practice where we're constantly, in the life of practice, we're constantly going up against some place, some unknown thing. We're kind of constantly going up against some unknownness in our own minds. And here's a particularly unpleasant one. So, that said, you've been here for, are you working somewhere? You have a job?
Or? Yeah, I work on a computer.
Yeah, okay. So at home or something like that. Yeah. I think in one sense, the most important thing is the mind of meditation. And I say that, and I think that the way I might see meditation might be a little differently from the way you might look at or what you're doing in your practice, if you're mm-hmm. practicing as a sort of, in a sort of Theravadan way of practice. When I teach someone about meditation, it's central to that is this idea of when something arises in the mind, we do a practice called serene reflection meditation, or shikantaza, or single-minded intense sitting. Anyway, zazen. It's also called themeless sitting. That's the phrase I was looking for. And what that means is that we just, when we come in and we sit, we just sit down and we allow whatever arises in the mind to arise in the mind, and we allow it to be there for as long as it wants to be and pass away, and we just sit down. We get, our habit of the mind is to get all caught up in what's going on in our minds. And we are trying to unlearn that habit of mind. So something arises, we start thinking about it. We start pursuing it off into somewhere, doing something with it, either how we want to get rid of that thing or how we want to grasp onto that thing. Basically, those are the two things. And so in terms of meditation, we're trying to diffuse that habit of mind and just allow things to arise and pass away and to sit still. This is a brief introduction or description of meditation, but I'm saying it briefly to give you a sense of it. So practically speaking, we're sitting there, we're just sitting, we get distracted, we notice we're distracted by something, some feeling or thought, and we just notice that and drop that and bring ourselves back to just sitting. And so when we're going through our daily life, and the thing that we did today where we're doing walking meditation and ceremonial, we bring that mind of meditation to all of those all of those things, where we get distracted in our mind, we notice that, we drop it, and we bring ourselves back to what we're doing. So you are working on your computer, you notice that you're distracted, you bring yourself back to just doing the work of your computer. You're vacuuming your house, you notice that you're distracted, you bring yourself back to vacuuming your house. And you're going to the store, you notice you're distracted by whatever it is, whether it's food porn, as you put it, or regular porn, or just the news, whatever it is. You just notice that, bring yourself back to whatever you're doing, and carry on. So the mind of meditation itself is our anchor and the most important thing.
Question.
Yes.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
I mean, if everybody has to go, it's okay. I'll just ask. I got two questions.
It's fine.
Okay, a mind of judging. So when I'm driving down the street and I see a billboard or something, my mind judges it.
Yeah.
Saying there's a big fat Big Mac or something on there.
Yeah.
I have to judge to say, I don't know, Buddha. I haven't studied Buddhism to the depth that you're talking about, like just a few books here. But I have to judge and decide whether or not that's something I want to say yes or no to. So it is a judgment. Or if I see somebody that's 500 pounds on the street in a wheelchair, I have to judge and say, not in a negative way. Is that an okay frame of mind from your lineage? And then
the way I look
answer at that, and then anger. I want to know what your Buddhist thoughts on anger are, because from what I've read, it's all anger is a delusion and it's bad.
Yeah.
And yet, done psychotherapy with a guy that's a Buddhist monk, in my opinion. And he says it's healthy to have some sense of anger if you're setting boundaries.
Hmm.
And he says Buddhism is completely off there on that. So I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah.
If we gotta go, we gotta go.
It's fine, and these two understand that they can.
Okay.
If they need to leave, they can go.
I
presume you understand that. So.
I say these with respect to.
Oh, I don't get any questions. Sense. Yeah, no worries.
All right. I don't know you. I don't know the lineage. I don't know anything about Zen at all.
Sure, sure.
But I'm very curious because this is the stuff that I get sitting in my practice.
Yeah.
I don't have the answers yet.
So first, the thing about judgment. Mm-hmm. We have as inherently as part of our Buddha nature, our essential deep nature, we have the ability for wise discernment. Mm-hmm. We can tell the difference between a cup and the digital recorder. Mm-hmm. We can see that. Mm-hmm. And if I want to get a drink, I know that I pick up my cup and I drink from it. Mm-hmm. If I want to record this Dharma talk, I turn on my digital recorder and I pay attention to it.
Right.
So in that sense, we can discern the differences between things. Mm-hmm. And we can base our choice about things in that discernment. A critical issue of all Buddhism, but especially paid attention to in the Zen tradition, mm-hmm. is how we handle that discriminatory mind, and particularly the mind which cuts things up into the opposites, which is goes to the issue of judgmentalism. If you see a billboard that has a Big Mac on it, or an advertisement for McDonald's, it can just be noticing there's a billboard with an advertisement for McDonald's, and that can arise as a noticing and pass away as a noticing. If you, in that arising and passing away, you're reminded that you're kind of hungry and that McDonald's has a decent breakfast menu where you can get a vegetarian whatever. I happen to be vegetarian, so I think, oh, maybe I'll stop in at McDonald's and get that. So that it may trigger some thing, or it may just say, oh, I see that and I'm hungry. And then you realize, oh, I haven't eaten today, so I better stop somewhere and get something to eat. That is a kind of neutral kind of process that's going on. And we don't have to be concerned about that neutral process that's going on.
Okay.
If you add to that some judgmentalism, like you notice the mm-hmm. billboard for McDonald's, and then you kind of go into being angry because McDonald's is a multinational corporation and they treat their employees badly, and I wish, and they're kind of edging out the small businesses and blah 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 and on and on, and you kind of notice yourself getting into a rant about that, mm-hmm. then you want to look at that from the point of view of practice. All of those things may be true or not true, that's not the issue. You can look at those things as neutral things, like you can know that McDonald's is a multinational corporation and they mm-hmm. screw up the beef production in the world, or they treat their workers badly, or whatever it is. And you can decide when you're investing your money in your stock portfolio that you don't want to invest in McDonald's. But that's can be a neutral experience. It doesn't have to be charged with some judgmentalism. If it's charged with judgmentalism, you know, fundamentally, that's not, it doesn't, the world doesn't care about that, but it is an important issue for us in that it, if it's charged with judgmentalism, likely as not, there's going to be suffering attached to it. Mm-hmm. There's going to be suffering as a result of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a place where we can look at our minds and work on letting go of some suffering, some thing that's creating a problem for us. Mm-hmm. So there's an element of training there. Now this points to the second most important thing of Dharma practice, which is looking at our lives, our minds, through the lens of the precepts. And we read something about that in the Shishogi that we talked about today. And in all Buddhist traditions, there's going to be some form of the precepts. Whether it's just cease from evil, do only good, purify your own heart, or do good for others. But most likely it's going to be don't kill, don't mm-hmm. steal, don't right. misuse sexuality, don't misuse, you know, mm-hmm. do right speech, and anyway, something mm-hmm. like that, five precepts.
So the one of delusion.
Well, that's one of the ten.
Oh.
But yeah, that's an important one. I was thinking.
I thought you were asking us.
Yeah, well, that's, thank you. I was sort of asking you. But what I was asking was, what are the five precepts that are usually practiced in Theravadan countries? So when we look at our minds, and one of the precepts as we articulate it is do not be angry. When we look at our minds from the point of view of meditation, there are three things that we call three poisons. And those three poisonous attitudes, the three poisons, are the areas of our mind that distract us from our fundamental neutral kind of position of meditation. And they're areas where we get distorted and create suffering. And those three poisonous attitudes are greed, anger, and delusion, misunderstanding. Greed is fairly self-explanatory. It's wanting what we don't have and misunderstanding that. Anger or hatred is, again, fairly kind of clear, where we hate something, we don't like it, we want to get rid of it, we want to kill it. Delusion is the misunderstanding of what the self is. Each one of those poisonous attitudes corresponds to training in the precepts. But it also corresponds to a thing that we do in terms of the mind of meditation. When something arises in the mind, it's a pleasant feeling. And our practice, our habit, conditioned habit, is to grasp after some pleasant feeling in the mind. If an unpleasant feeling arises in the mind, or an unpleasant thought arises in the mind, our conditioned habit is to push it away, to try to get rid of it. And that's actually the genesis for anger. That's where anger is. Delusion is the trying to convince ourselves that something is otherwise than it actually is. That it, kind of fundamentally. So all of those things are going on when we're sitting. But if we're looking at our minds again from the precepts, we can kind of say, okay, so you're driving down the street, you see the McDonald's billboard, and you think, evil multinational corporation, I need to get some money, so I'm going to kill two birds with one stone by attacking the evil multinational corporation, and I'm going to get a gun and go rob a McDonald's store. That is a kind of classical, so this thought arises in your mind, that's a kind of classical recipe for a lot of suffering, and it contains greed, if you follow up on it, delusion, misunderstanding, and anger, hatred. And you can kind of then, so that feeling arises, that thought arises in your mind, kind of look at your mind and your mindful awareness of your mind and think, I wonder if I did that, if it would be preceptual. So you kind of run it across the precepts. Oh, it's stealing. No, that wouldn't be perceptual. Oh, it's being angry. Oh, that wouldn't be perceptual. Oh, it's selling the wine of delusion. Oh, that wouldn't be perceptual. So you kind of got three flags there that say, don't do that. So you see that and you think, okay, that impulse arises. I'm going to let it go. I'm going to restrain myself from it. See what I'm getting at? That's how we work with the Dharma, how we bring it into practice in our daily life, or one way. And honestly, no, the Buddhists don't have it wrong about anger. You don't need to have anger to set up boundaries. All you have to have is wise discernment and the ability to say no. And that's not anger. It can be useful. I'm not trying to say don't do it or follow the advice of your therapist. But I am saying the possibility exists to live in a world, live in a mind, to have a mind that doesn't partake of anger. And I think that it is useful to know that. Mm-hmm. That therapist may be quite wise, but probably actually doesn't have the experience of practicing the Dharma. Mm-hmm.
And if somebody is hurting your child in a moment, and that person gets angry and has to protect.
Take vigorous.
And kill, potentially.
Take vigorous action.
And take the sword out and potentially do serious damage.
Yep.
There's going to be anger in that person.
Sure. Maybe.
Unless they're practicing completely enlightened whatever. There may or may not be. Or maybe there was killing with heart still intentionally there. That's what this gentleman was saying is
sure.
You're able to be angry, not in the hostility sense, but able to take out your sword and kill, but also stay compassionate with your wife, with your kids, with whoever it might be. And that's what I'm, his point. And I don't know, because that's, I don't know anything about the Buddhist,
yeah,
traditional
well,
Buddhism.
The
they
way
say, no. But
the way that I would understand that is that we act in the world and we're willing to take the consequences for it.
Right.
There's a precept about not killing.
Right.
And we can take that precept. I know people who are, for instance, take that precept, but who are in the military and who kill
right.
in that sense. In one sense, they... they may be doing it out of a place of compassion. They may do it from a place from anger, I don't know. But the critical thing is that they're willing to take the consequences of that action. There is no... The precepts in Buddhism are not like commandments from God, thou shalt not or thou must not. They're saying, here are some areas of human life where typically suffering is, where there's typically suffering. If there's anger arising, it can be that there's suffering there, or there will follow on suffering. If, you know, sometimes your kid, you know, you have children, your kid puts their, is about to put their hand in the flame of the stove, and you yell at them, and honestly, it's anger, and they stop. That can be a very good thing. Because it's helping them to learn before they know from experience that they're going to hurt themselves. I have no problem with that. I don't want to try to get in the way of anybody doing any particular thing.
Right.
But I also know that the Buddha taught that if, he said, if someone should come and to dismember you joint by joint with a sword, and you give rise to ill will and hatred, you are not a disciple of mine. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't honestly say that I would be able to do that. Mm-hmm. People mess with me and I just kind of lose it. A little bit more restrained than that.
That's the whole basis of monastery China, martial arts fighting too, which these guys are fighting. But they're also in deep love with each other, and they know one punch is also, it has to be to liberate. So, I mean, we're going in a whole other realm here, but
yeah.
As a training in martial arts, there's a whole other aspect of that.
Well, 99% of the monks, Buddhist monks, anywhere in the world are not practicing martial arts.
Okay, well, maybe that's a small part that I know of.
Yeah, it's... And I don't have a problem, again, it's just a thing that they do. And monks over time have, you know, like people, Buddhists are human beings, they do all kinds of things.
Right.
And again, I'm not trying to say they should or shouldn't, but just and again, that point about being dismembered joint by joint with a sword, I just know that if anger arises in my mind, and I indulge it, there is more training for me that I can do. And there is no doctrinal justification for that. There's no such thing in Buddhism as righteous anger. That's a Christian notion. Just because there isn't righteous anger doesn't mean that in the context of a particular situation, it can be good to take a step in which you give expression to anger. But you have to be willing to take the consequences for that. Your child, when you yell at them before they put their hand in the stove, is going to feel the the impact of your anger on them. Mm-hmm. They're going to have their feelings hurt.
Right.
And in terms of practice, we can know that and then take steps to ameliorate that. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I understand. You're wounding that kid.
Yeah.
That kid is wounded now.
Yeah. And so
they can come, their pure nature is now has a whatever level.
Right.
Yeah.
Now fundamentally that's not a good thing, but fundamentally it's not a problem.
Right.
It's something that you can work with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
And it takes a while, it just takes a while for us to take the Dharma and to learn how to make use of it in the world in a real way. The Dharma is designed to practice in the real world. It's designed to help us to not suffer in the world as we actually encounter it. Not in a monastery setting. Like I say, a monastery is a bit of a hothouse. We retreat to a monastery now and then to help us to deepen our sense of the thing. But we live our life in the world. Okay, anything else? Hopefully I haven't said anything to confuse or upset anyone. And if I have, please track me down and take me to task for it. Okay. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to spend time with you.